This is the Missouri First map. This map was drawn here, made here, for here, by our team.
For your team to steal a U.S. House seat in Missouri, Governor Kehoe.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Nice going.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Voters have another idea.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
However.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
We'll discuss.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today for the Bradcast. As the Republican shutdown of the federal government, perhaps better described at this point as the Jeffrey Epstein shutdown, you think, Des?
Hi, oh,
Desi,
yes.
Doyen.
Definitely.
Well, it's because House Speaker Mike Johnson will not even allow the House itself to be in session at all to carry out its business, since Arizona voters elected Democrat Adelita Grijalva to the U.S. House about 3 weeks ago as the deciding bipartisan signature to force a vote on the release of the Epstein files. He won't even let the House open to avoid having that happen. So at this point, it seems to me Donald Trump is happy to keep the government shut down entirely because Mike Johnson is using it as sort of his last remaining excuse to prevent a vote on the release of the Epstein files.
Bingo.
So as the Republican Jeffrey Epstein shutdown of government continues now, entering its third week, so does the Republicans' anti-small-D Democratic anti-voter gerrymandering war. That continues with new Republican states, or at least those with a Republican legislature like North Carolina, vowing to jump into the matter to re-gerrymander their own already gerrymandered U.S. House map to try and give Republicans an even greater advantage next year. We'll get to that in a moment, and we'll be joined by a guest from Missouri, my old home state, where the GOP legislature and governor have already passed the new law to re-gerrymander that state to steal at least one more seat from Democratic voters and give it to Republicans next year, or at least try to. But as you will see, voters in Missouri are not taking this lying down. They have a plan to stop that new gerrymandering law dead in its tracks before next year's election. And my guest, helping to lead the effort, seems pretty confident that it will work. Richard von Glahn from the People Not Politicians organization joins us momentarily to discuss that. It is a rainy day here in Los Angeles and apparently across much of the U.S., where cold October rains are coming in now from all directions. On the East Coast, the West Coast, up in Alaska, across Arizona and Colorado and beyond. Desi Doyen will have more on that in our latest Green News Report, also
yes,
a little bit later. We hope you had a nice Indigenous Peoples Day on Monday, or a nice Columbus Day for those who celebrate. There was, as usual, a lot going on over the weekend, including the very good news, at least for now, of the remaining living hostages. Israeli hostages being held by Hamas finally being returned to their families in Israel in exchange for nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners released by Israel, and what has so far proved to be at least a temporary ceasefire to allow both the exchange of hostages for prisoners, the pullback of Israeli forces from portions of the war-torn Gaza enclave, the critical flow of humanitarian aid to be restored into Gaza, and for Donald Trump to make a weekend appearance in the Middle East to take credit for it all, whether deservedly or not. That ceasefire, barely a few days old, however, with that exchange of hostages for prisoners barely one day old, is already beginning to show a few cracks, unfortunately, as we had warned might happen last week. Israel's military said it opened fire on Tuesday to remove a threat posed by suspects who they say approached its forces in the northern Gaza Strip. And health authorities in the enclave said at least 6 Palestinians had been killed by Israeli fire. The military said the suspects had crossed a boundary for an initial Israeli pullback under the U.S.-brokered ceasefire plan in violation of the deal. Gaza's local authority said the Israeli military killed 6 Palestinians in 2 separate incidents across Gaza on Tuesday, after Donald Trump accurately or otherwise declared the end of the 2-year-long war, which began with Hamas's October 2023 attack on Israel that killed some 1,200 people, and Israel's response that has reportedly killed more than 67,000 people in return, the majority of them women or children. Moreover, Reuters is also reporting that Israel restricted aid into Gaza and kept the enclave's border shut on Tuesday, while reemergent Hamas fighters demonstrated their grip by executing men, fellow Palestinians, in the street, darkening the outlook for Trump's plan to actually end this war, as Reuters describes it. Israel told the United Nations that it will allow only 300 aid trucks into Gaza. That is half the agreed daily number beginning on Wednesday, and that no fuel or gas will be allowed in except for specific needs related to humanitarian infrastructure. That, according to a note seen by Reuters and confirmed by the UN. 3 Israeli officials earlier said that Israel had decided to restrict aid and delay plans to open the southern border crossing to Egypt because Hamas had been too slow to turn over bodies of dead hostages. Trump has given his blessing to Hamas to reassert some control of Gaza, at least temporarily. Israeli officials who say any final settlement must permanently disarm Hamas have so far refrained from commenting publicly on the reemergence of the group's fighters. On Monday, the U.S. president proclaimed the, quote, historic dawn of a new Middle East to Israel's parliament. That may be a bit early, we'll see, but so far Hamas has been slow in handing over coffins of dead hostages, and aid trucks have yet to be permitted to enter Gaza at the fully anticipated rate of hundreds per day. Plans have yet to be implemented to open the crossing to Egypt to let some Gazans out initially to evacuate the wounded for medical treatment. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has consistently maintained that the war cannot end until Hamas gives up its weapons and ceases to control Gaza, a demand that the fighters have rejected, torpedoing all previous peace efforts. The group, though Hamas, greatly weakened after 2 years of pummeling Israeli bombardment and ground incursions, has been gradually reasserting itself in the days since the ceasefire took hold. It has deployed hundreds of workers to start rubble clearing on key routes needed to access damaged or destroyed housing and to repair broken water pipes. Road clearance and security provision will also be needed for increased aid delivery. So, obviously, very good news about the release of the hostages over the weekend, but as we warned, caution is due for where the situation goes from here. Despite Donald Trump's singular quest, not so much for peace, but for a Nobel Peace Prize that he feels he deserves for some reason, even while he unleashes U.S. troops against U.S. citizens in U.S. cities, and as news of yet another attack on a Venezuelan vessel by the U.S. military was reported late today, with the U.S. claiming once again, to have killed narco-terrorists, but refusing to offer any evidence at all to support that claim, as they otherwise continue extrajudicial killings in pretty clear violation of international law. Other than that, yeah, he thinks he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. All of which serves as a reminder of what we have to do back here at home, which is to vote out our own fascist regime at the next possible opportunity. To that end, there was an election last week up in Alaska that I was not able to cover at the time, but I do want to mention now, as it is another indication that voters here in the U.S. are doing their part to reverse the dark course that we are now on, with Democrats in special elections and local elections consistently seeing about a 15-point swing in their direction in election after election. In Alaska, last week, Fairbanks Mayor David Prus, a Republican, conceded to Mindy O'Neill, a Democrat, in the mayoral election held on Tuesday last week. According to unofficial election night results made available by the city of Fairbanks, O'Neill received 54% of the vote to Prus 46% of the vote. So an 8-point victory for the Democrat in what Newsweek is describing as a, quote, shock election defeat for the Republicans. In a state that hasn't elected a Democrat for president since Lyndon B. Johnson in 1964, or a Democrat as the mayor of Fairbanks in over a decade. The ballot in mayoral elections in Fairbanks does not actually list party affiliations next to the candidates' names, but Republicans have held the role in Fairbanks for nearly a decade, backed by Republicans. David Prus was ran as, well, not as a Republican, but backed by them. He was elected mayor back in 2022. He was running for a second term. O'Neill, the victor last week, was the presiding officer of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly, and she was endorsed by the Alaska Democratic Party. Democrats flipping the seat, according to Newsweek, comes as the party hopes to compete in statewide contests for the U.S. Senate and House next year. The state has only elected one Democratic senator since 1981 and only one Democratic House member since 1973, but they are hopeful. Prus in Fairbanks blamed low voter turnout and O'Neill having the support of the state Democratic Party for his defeat. But yeah, well, people do tend to vote for Democrats when they don't like what Republicans are doing. So, yeah. duh. but this was unusual in that an incumbent mayor has not been unseated in a very long time up in Fairbanks, according to KUAC-TV. And it is yet another sign that Republicans should be very, very worried about what voters are likely to do next year when they will have their first chance to ring in all 50 states on how they think both the White House and the Republican-led Congress are doing. To that end, amidst an otherwise very busy weekend, Donald Trump and the Republican Party's war on democracy continues this week, including at the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday, where the corrupted court is hearing a case that many, including myself, by the way, believe is likely to be used by the court to largely overturn what little is left of the Voting Rights Act and its Section 2, and potentially upending next year's midterm elections in the bargain by unleashing maybe dozens of GOP-controlled states to mid-decade redistricting to erase majority-minority voting districts previously enacted under the Voting Rights Act for the U.S. House, along with, by the way, state and local legislative seats. So the case being heard on Wednesday in the Supreme Court is a very big deal. We will be talking about it in more detail as the week goes on. For now, however, as you know, we've been covering Donald Trump's direct call on GOP-controlled states to redraw their U.S. House maps in the middle of the decade in advance of next year's critical midterm elections in order to flip as many Democratic-leaning districts from blue to red as possible, simply because Trump justifiably fears that Republicans will see their slim U.S. House majority wiped out by Democrats next year due to his and his party's wildly unpopular policies. So, several GOP-controlled states and state legislatures are doing whatever they can by bending rules and laws in order to favor Republicans, to remove Democratic seats in majority-minority districts in hopes of redrawing those districts in hopes of hanging on to a Republican majority in the U.S. House next year. It started, of course, with Trump urging Texas Governor Greg Abbott to order a special legislative session to redraw five Democratic seats in the Lone Star State that are currently represented by minorities in hopes of flipping them to Republican seats next year. In response, California's Democratic governor and state legislature introduced a state constitutional proposal to temporarily redraw its U.S. House maps to flip five Republican seats here in California to Democrats next year in response. But that's not all. Several other GOP-controlled states are attempting to flip Democratic seats as well before a single vote is even cast next year. Yes, they are rigging next year's election. On Monday this week, North Carolina Republican legislators announced plans to vote on redrawing that state's U.S. House district map with the aim of securing yet another GOP seat in the state's already gerrymandered U.S. House map. North Carolina Republicans already created a map back in 2023 that resulted in GOP candidates winning 10 of the state's 14 U.S. House seats last year. That division, 10 Republicans to 4 Democrats, can be compared to what happened in 2002 when the state split evenly 7-7 between Democrats and the GOP under the court-ordered map that was used back in 2022 in the otherwise very evenly divided state, which has elected Democrats to the governor's mansion over the past three statewide elections, even while voting for Donald Trump in each of those same elections. So, yes, a very closely divided state. The state's U.S. House maps were fairly drawn for a short time back in 2022. That led to a 7-7 split.
Until the Republicans got involved and decided to gerrymander it even further.
Well, what happened was the Republicans took back over the state Supreme Court, and that corrupted state Supreme Court allowed maps that were found by the previous court to have been an unlawful partisan gerrymander. So now, only one of the state's House districts, the first district currently represented by Democrat Congressman Don Davis, only one is considered to be a swing district.
Good Lord.
And that one is now being eyed by the GOP to turn it into an 11th Republican seat next year. A news release from the state's Republican legislators said that their planned action, quote, follows President Donald Trump's call urging legislatures across the country to redistrict their maps before next year's midterms. That, of course, rather than simply changing their policies to ones that the American people, the American voters might actually want to vote for all by themselves. That's right out. That's a crazy idea, apparently. We'll just rig the maps instead. And in Missouri, my old home state, Republicans have already adopted a measure that will likely result in stealing one of the few remaining blue seats from voters. But here's the good news. Voters appear to have a plan for that as well, to prevent the gerrymander from even happening in the first place, even though it has already been adopted by the state legislature and signed by the state's Republican governor. We will discuss that plan and how Republicans are trying to block that plan in turn next on the broadcast with People Not Politicians, Richard Von Glahn. That is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hey. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Right on. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Lawmakers in the Republican-led Show Me State of Missouri recently approved revised U.S. House district maps in order to help Republicans win an additional seat in a state where Republicans already hold 6 of the 8 U.S. House seats, with Democrats currently holding only the seats in urban St. Louis in the eastern portion of the state and in Kansas City on the state's western border. That is the seat currently held by Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, which he has held since 2005 and which is now being redrawn by state Republicans in hopes of flipping it from blue to red next year. But that newly redrawn Missouri map is facing both a bunch of court challenges and a people's ballot initiative campaign seeking to force a statewide ballot referendum on it next year. If the referendum is placed on the ballot, even before it's voted on, it would stop the legislative redistricting dead in its tracks, as I understand it. Last month, Missouri voters filed a lawsuit that challenges the GOP's new congressional map, calling it an unconstitutional gerrymander that dismantles Kansas City's black Democratic representation and rigs the 2026 elections. The plaintiffs, represented by the ACLU and Campaign Legal Center, argue that Governor Mike Kehoe, a Republican, violated the Missouri Constitution by convening a special session to redraw congressional districts just 3 years after the state already approved new maps following the 2020 census. Quote, at the demand of President Trump and contrary to the plain text of the Missouri Constitution and decades of precedent, the complaint argues, Governor Kehoe recently called an extraordinary session of the Missouri legislature to jam through an unconstitutional mid-decade redraw of the state's congressional districts with the goal of preventing Kansas City voters from electing their preferred candidate to Congress. The lawsuit highlights that lawmakers, quote, sprinted through hearings and enacted a new map in just a week and a half's time with, quote, no transparency. It argues that the rush to pass the gerrymander was designed to avoid scrutiny and deliver a map that splits Kansas City into multiple districts. Quote, while publicly acknowledging that the map was being redrawn to defeat black Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, the governor nonsensically cited the obviously pretextual claim that there was some Voting Rights Act or 14th Amendment violation with the 2022 map in his proclamation calling the extraordinary session, the complaint notes. Now, that Voting Rights Act or 14th Amendment violation is precisely what Republicans are hoping that the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court will declare for all majority-minority districts drawn under the Voting Rights Act in the Louisiana case that they are hearing this week at the High Court. The plaintiffs, meanwhile, in the Missouri case, also argue that the map violates Missouri's constitutional requirement that districts be, quote, as compact as may be, which is not the case here. The new 4th and 5th districts drawn by, or approved, I should say, by the state legislature in the western part of the state are described as meandering and bizarrely shaped, with one featuring a, quote, giraffe neck appendage into Kansas City that splits black communities there. But as that legal challenge proceeds, there is also a critical effort by voters on the ground to prevent the map from taking effect at all next year and tilting Missouri's House delegation to a 7-1 Republican supermajority. Missouri democracy advocates are mobilizing to give voters a chance to block the state's new Trump-ordered gerrymander via ballot measure, even as Republican officials are pulling out all the stops to stymie their efforts. As Democracy Docket reported last week, last month a pro-voting coalition filed a petition with the state to hold a referendum on the gerrymander. If organizers can gather enough signatures, the gerrymander would be blocked for the 2026 midterms, while voters would decide next year whether to reject it permanently or not. People, not politicians, the coalition organizing the petition effort, you will not be surprised to learn, is already facing challenges from the state's attorney general and secretary of state, both of them Republicans, as they try to nullify signatures already gathered last month to put this matter up for a vote next year. If they can even just get it on the ballot, that would, as noted, effectively block the recent gerrymander from taking effect at all, at least next year, until voters statewide are allowed to ring in on the matter. Joining us now is Richard Von Glahn. He is the director, policy director of Missouri Jobs with Justice and policy director of People Not Politicians, the coalition leading the ballot referendum effort. Mr. Von Glahn has worked on 10 previous Missouri ballot initiatives, including the one that just last year raised the minimum wage for Missourians and provided workers paid sick leave in the state, a measure which was adopted by voters last November by 58-42% of the vote. Richard Von Glahn, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to how state officials are trying to stack the deck against your citizen-led referendum effort here, tell me about what is effectively the citizens' veto provision that you are relying on in Missouri's state constitution to carry this out.
Yeah, since the state constitution of 1875, so 150 years, Missourians have had the right to place issues on the ballot, to referendums on legislation passed by our General Assembly if we think that legislation is not aligned with our values. Mm-hmm. To do so, we have to gather a certain number of signatures. It's about 110,000 right now in Missouri. And then we can let the people decide if the legislation passed by the General Assembly should go into effect or if they should have to start over. We have done this 27 times in Missouri's history, and 25 of those 27 times that an issue's been put up for a vote, the citizens have overridden what the legislature has done.
Really? There's an idea. Now, this is, as I understand it, has been in place in Missouri since at least 1945. Was this the same provision that was used that resulted in voters last year enshrining the right to an abortion into the state constitution after state lawmakers had adopted a near-total abortion ban in Missouri?
That's a slightly different process. Uh-huh. There is also a proactive initiative process that you can use that was done on with abortion and that I worked on the minimum wage and paid sick leave last year. But this is technically a different process. This is a referendum. This is like a citizen veto of what the legislature did. So it's simply putting the exact bill that the legislature passed, putting it up for the general population and say, well, let's see if the legislature was aligned with what voters wanted or not.
And I love that, being a democracy advocate myself. I love that. Now, between that, Richard, and the abortion measure last year on the ballot, the hike in the state's minimum wage and sick leave provision that you worked on last year, and the referendum 2 years earlier to legalize marijuana in the state. Again, as I recall, against wishes of state Republicans at the time. It sure does seem to me, sitting from the outside here, it sure does seem to me that Republican policies are unpopular in that state when they're put up for a vote. For some reason, nonetheless, the state continues to put Republicans into power year after year. Why is that, as you see it? Can you sort of explain that apparent disconnect to me between what we see in the ballot measures and what we see going on in Jeff City?
Well, you're certainly correct at the ballot measures. I mean, the last time the citizen referendum was used, it was in 2018 mm-hmm. when the legislature had passed a right-to-work law to attack workers' collective bargaining rights. And voters rejected that at about 68%. So it is certainly true that our legislature is out of touch with what most Missouri voters want. And that actually speaks to the exact issue that we're fighting right now and the problem that I think gerrymandering really creates is it creates legislative districts that shield legislators from political accountability mm-hmm. when their ideas are unpopular. And so we have a gerrymandered state legislature right mm-hmm. now, which is why I think you continue to see mm-hmm. popular issues being resisted in Jefferson City or being countered in Jefferson City. And we certainly want to make sure that that dynamic does not replicate itself in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Now, just a month or so ago, when this idea initially came up to redraw Missouri's congressional maps after, you know, Trump was haranguing Republicans to do this, well, a number of Republicans in the state, in Missouri, had said they were against the idea. What happened here in that intervening time between when it looked like, well, Missouri state officials were going to say no, and then they ultimately passed this measure?
Yeah, I mean, you saw state legislative leaders in both chambers say, no, we've already done redistricting.
Right.
We have never done a mid-cycle redistricting in the history of Missouri. So this was really out of the norm as to what was expected. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I think too many of them lack the courage to follow through on their convictions. Now, I will point out, it was a bipartisan vote against this in both the House and the Senate. Mm. And one senator, a man named Lincoln Huff from Springfield, Missouri, who was the chairman of the Budget Committee, one of the most powerful positions in the legislature, he voted against this and he was removed as chairman from that committee for doing so.
Really?
So I want to acknowledge there were courageous actors on both sides mm-hmm. of the aisle, but ultimately you saw, I think, politics at its worst play out over about 3 weeks in late August, early September.
Wow. So I was drawn to this effort, citizen-led referendum effort, when I saw that the state's Republican Attorney General and Secretary of State were attempting to reject thousands of signatures that you guys had gathered for this effort to put the redrawn map up for a vote on next year's ballot. On what grounds were those signatures rejected? How is it setting back your effort there? And where does the legal challenge on that rejection currently stand in court, Richard?
Yeah, so that was it is a completely frivolous action by the Attorney General. What the state constitution requires is after a bill is passed by the General Assembly, citizens can file a petition for a referendum and then begin collecting signatures. Mm-hmm. That is what we did. 3 hours after the bill was passed, we filed the referendum and 48 hours later, we started gathering signatures. Well, 2 weeks later, the Attorney General offered an opinion saying, you can't gather signatures on a bill. You can only gather signatures on a law. And so because the governor had not signed it yet, she is arguing that those signatures shouldn't count. Now, keep in mind, the Missouri Constitution uses two phrases when talking about the right to a referendum. It refers to a bill and to an act of the General Assembly. It does not refer to a law. Mm. So the Attorney General just sort of made up a section of the Constitution or made up words in the Constitution to try to thwart this. Ultimately, we have sued on that. I feel confident that our position will prevail. The Missouri Supreme Court has traditionally defended this long-held right. Like I said, it's 150 years that Missourians have had this. The Supreme Court has traditionally been on the sides of voters on this. So I feel confident that we're going to be fine either way. But we are also going to turn in such an overwhelming number of signatures that whether the signatures from the first 2 weeks are counted or not is not going to be the deciding factor.
Well, that's good news to hear. How many signatures are we talking about that could be thrown out if they're successful in striking those down?
You know, we're probably talking about 25,000 signatures, which is significant. And yeah. I think the Supreme Court is going to look at that and say, do we really want to silence the voice of 25,000 Missourians who are attempting to speak up on this? And we're going to defend those Missourians, right?
And how long do you have to get? So you, I think you said it was about 110,000 signatures is what you need to come up with. How long do you have to come up with that?
We have until December 11th is when the signatures are due.
Okay. And you feel you're still on course whether or not those 25,000 end up getting approved or thrown out?
We are not just on pace. We are ahead of pace. I will say in the 72 hours after the legislature first passed this, we had over 2,000 Missourians volunteer, say, put a clipboard in my hands. I'm ready to go out and hit the streets and talk to my neighbors. And so the result has been we've just, you know, we plan out campaigns, what's the pacing that we need, and we just continue to exceed that day after day. And so I feel very confident about this.
That is good news. And so if I understand it correctly, the law adopted by the state Republicans, that will automatically become at least temporarily blocked if and when you guys get approved for this measure on, is it next spring's ballot or next November 2026 ballot?
So when we turn in signatures and they are reviewed and approved, we go on the November 2026 ballot.
Okay.
Now, there's the option, the General Assembly, not the governor, not the Secretary of State, the General Assembly could pass a law moving our election earlier in the cycle. So they could try to move it up to May or April and have a vote at that point. That will not be easy for them. That will take some legislative maneuvering. As I mentioned, there's some real discord in the Republican caucus, given some of the punishments that were merited out for not, you know, following lockstep with leadership demands. I don't know that they have a very easy road to do that, but they do have that option.
And if they have that option, we're talking about a spring election. Let's say this gets on the ballot. They're successful in keeping it on the spring ballot. Would that then allow, I mean, are at that point, aren't we talking about primaries for the House races? Would there still be time to sort of redraw the maps one way or another after April or May of next year?
That is where the calendar gets very tricky. Filing for Congress in Missouri goes from late February to late March.
Right.
They are not going to be able to have an election by the time the filing deadline closes. So I think the, you know, the safest thing for them is to say, okay, we had an idea. The citizens checked us. The vote's going to be in November, and we'll go on in 2028 and see what we have. But of course, you know, that's asking for sanity in our politics, and that's not what produced this situation to begin with.
No, I guess it isn't. Also, earlier this year, as I understand it, the Missouri State Senate passed a law, or passed a bill, I should say, that would make it more difficult for voters to adopt ballot initiatives, even when they are supported by a majority of voters on the ballot in the state. Can you explain what they're attempting to do there, even though, as I understand it, the state house has yet to adopt that same measure?
So that is actually something that at this, on the same special session that produced the gerrymandered map, they also passed a proposed constitutional amendment that would make it more difficult for citizens to pass proactive initiatives, not referendums that were running on the gerrymandering, but on proactive initiatives like the abortion rights campaign or the minimum wage campaign. Now, that proposal, it would change Missouri's constitution, so it has to face voters. And their idea here is widely unpopular. It would allow an issue that received over 90% of a popular vote to still be defeated at the ballot. And I think voters look at that and know that that's a ridiculous proposal.
How would that happen? If it gets 90%, how would it not pass?
So it requires that you win a majority and all 8 congressional districts that Missouri has.
Really?
So even if you won 100% in 7 districts and 49.9% in the 8th district, you would lose.
Wow.
And so Missourians understand that that's not the way to run an election. It's a ridiculous idea. But they have referred that to the ballot as well. I'm not sure which ballot they want that to be on, but I expect another loss for the Missouri legislature when that idea faces voters.
So that has now passed in both houses to get onto the ballot at some point.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct.
Yes.
But Missouri voters will have the final say there as well.
Good. So. Always leave it to the voters. They seem to get it right more often than not, at least when they're given a fair choice in a fair election. I know that Republicans across the country have introduced more than 150 bills to make it harder for voters in states that allow citizens' ballot initiatives of various types to, you know, to get them on the ballot at all or to pass them into law. If they are allowed to put them on the ballot, like the constitutional measure we're talking about here that would require a majority in every congressional district, the idea in Missouri that would have to happen, or that it would require 60%, not 50%, to be approved by voters. We've seen that in other states. For the moment, however, in Missouri, we're looking at, in this case, in your case, the measure you're working on, a simple majority, right, would block this measure for good, at least until after the next census, if it's successful, if it's on the ballot, and if it gets basically 50% plus one of voters vote for it?
Yeah, our election is just like most elections in the country, like candidate elections. It's whichever side gets the most wins, and it'll be a simple yes or no on our question.
Democracy. Fascinating. Is the National Democratic Party helping out with this effort as one might expect them to, or are you guys sort of on your own out there in Missouri on this?
You know, certainly the Democratic Party, I think, has an interest in this. I certainly recognize that the target here is for a partisan gain and targeting Reverend Cleaver. That said, when we're out gathering signatures, and even our volunteers are not just Democrats, voters don't ask us, well, will this benefit Republicans or Democrats? Because this is actually about centering voters in our democracy. No one wants to feel like a political pawn or that our elections are manipulated behind our backs. And so that's why, as we're out working on this and talking to voters, it is not a partisan message. It is really, like the name says, people, not politicians, should be the center and focus of our democracy.
And finally, Richard von Glahn, even though this issue obviously affects Missouri's House, U.S. House delegation, the matter of who controls the House after next year's midterms is obviously critically important to the entire country. Is there anything that those of us outside of the Show Me State can do right now to support this effort in Missouri.
Yeah, obviously, whatever corner of the country you might live in, who controls Congress can have a big, big say. And in Missouri, this isn't going to be left up to politicians or even to the courts to decide what happens. It is about the voters here. And so if anyone wants to, for instance, make a contribution to help, you know, help us with the printing costs of printing petitions or bottles of water or pens or clipboards, all of the things we in Missouri need to engage in our direct democracy, you can find our website is just peoplenotpoliticiansmo.org. And you can go there and you can find ways to get involved, to support the effort. And all of that support is really greatly, greatly appreciated because there's a lot of Missourians working hard for this. And anything anyone can do to support us, we really appreciate and love.
Richard von Glahn is the policy director of People Not Politicians. Once again, their website is peoplenotpoliticiansmo.org. You can also find them on Blue Sky at People Not Pauls, P-O-L-S, People Not Pauls, M-O as well. Richard, really appreciate your effort out there. Hope you will stay in touch. Good luck with all you are doing, and thank you for it, and thank you for joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
All right. Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. All right. I got to tell you, I obviously take particular note of Missouri because that's my home state,
yes.
But it also drives me absolutely nuts. When I left the state, I don't know about how many decades ago, it was a very purple state. As noted, it is now, people think of it as deep red. And yet, whenever they get something on the ballot, like, oh, protect the right to abortion, give folks paid sick leave, they vote over and over again for, you know, very progressive policies. Much more like the purple state that I remember as a kid before I left.
I think it is still a purple state, maybe slightly redder than it used to be. But obviously, when you look at statewide elections, when voters get the chance to vote on progressive issues, that's what they choose. And I think it's a similar state in Texas as well. Texas used to be purple. I think it still kind of
is.
Used
to be a deep blue back in Texas.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
And that has obviously changed. But I think that is, that voters in those states really do need help to reassert progressive values among the electorate because it's super hard now.
And they're also just, you know, one of the reasons we do what we do is because voters in Missouri, voters in Texas, everywhere in the country are just wildly, wildly disinformed.
Yes.
And misinformed, whether it's by the corporate media, whether it's by social media. I mean, it's just so difficult to get good information to voters these days. You see what happens.
Well, and one of the things that Richard said that really jumped out at me is he said the minute that they announced that they were going to launch this program, that 2 hours later, they got 2,000 people to sign up. And I think that when you say voters are so deeply disinformed and misinformed, those people signed up to say, give me a clipboard and I will go out and talk to my neighbors. And I think that's a great example of how people, no matter where you are, no matter what state you're in, you can get involved, you can get engaged, you can pick an issue or a group that you care about, find your people. They really need the help.
There is something for everyone to do in this autocracy. You don't have to just sit back and watch it happen. By the way, I understand there's a bit of a protest or something taking place this weekend.
Yes, the No Kings protest, October 18th on Saturday. Lots of people are signing up.
Do I have to travel to Washington, D.C. to take part in that?
You do not.
What?
I was looking it up, and there are so many in so many communities that even within the same cities, you'll find, I'm sure, plenty to go and show and rally for.
Something like 2,500 more, I think, than 2,500 different protests that are taking place all over the country. So you don't have to travel to Washington.
Right.
Just go to, I think it's nokings.org, and you can find a protest near you if you'd like to meet like-minded people who hopefully have not been wildly misinformed and disinformed over these years.
Get involved. That's it.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we will come back with, oh, hey, Desi Doyen.
Hey.
It's your Green News Report.
Yeah.
That's straight ahead on your broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only one that keeps us here. Thank you. Well, it seems like everyone across the country, I'm sure it's not everyone, but a whole lot of folks across the country are getting drenched this week with storms, like tropical storms coming from all directions, Desi Doyen.
Yes, it's pretty wild.
It is, as discussed in our latest Green News Report.
And it's just been all hands on deck.
Extreme storms generate torrential rains and deadly flooding across the entire U.S. from the East Coast to the West Coast to Alaska.
While many things went wrong, the problem was not a grid that's over-reliant on wind and solar.
Spain's massive blackout earlier this year was not caused by renewable energy, new report confirms. Plus,
I know that Alabama was in the original forecast.
Senate confirms Trump's Sharpiegate meteorologist to head NOAA.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
They've also frozen $8 billion in climate projects across 16 blue and purple states. The Office of Management and Budget has not publicly announced cuts that affected a state that backed Trump in 2024. Well, that is good news for federal projects in red states, like North Dakota's Ronald Reagan Oil Field and Memorial Whorehouse. You know their slogan, drill, baby, drill.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know they say March comes in like a lion, but boy, is October coming in like a lion with rain everywhere in this country.
Yes, no kidding. Extreme weather is severely testing the nation's infrastructure all across the U.S. Over the weekend, New Jersey's governor issued a state of emergency as a powerful Atlantic nor'easter churns its way up the East Coast, bringing high winds, rain, and floods, and killing at least three people. In western Mexico, Tropical Storm Priscilla in the Pacific unleashed rain and floods that killed at least 47 people. In southern Colorado, thousands were forced to evacuate after remnants of Priscilla overwhelmed upgraded flood control systems. As we go to air, the same storm, Priscilla, is pummeling Southern California, triggering warnings of flooding and mudslides in areas burned in catastrophic wildfires last January. And in western Alaska, more than 30 people were rescued after the remnants of Typhoon Halong brought hurricane-force winds, catastrophic flooding, and widespread damage to multiple coastal communities, even sweeping away entire houses.
All of this, of course, coming while FEMA is out during the government shutdown?
FEMA is operating with a limited skeleton staff, and it's unclear how many actual FEMA federal agents are on the ground in any of these areas.
And they were a skeleton staff under the Trump administration even before the shutdown.
Amid all that, remember Sharpiegate? Back in 2019, Donald Trump, in his first term, used a Sharpie to alter an official hurricane forecast map, insisting falsely that the storm threatened Alabama. Back then, the acting head of NOAA, Neil Jacobs, was found to have violated ethics rules for releasing a statement backing Trump's false narrative and criticizing the National Weather Service staffers who accurately contradicted it. Last week, the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate confirmed that guy to officially head up NOAA. In his confirmation hearing, Jacobs said he supports Trump's agenda to dismantle NOAA's climate science research.
And you can put that in permanent ink.
Here in the U.S., the Trump White House expanded its attack on American-made renewable energy. The administration canceled what would have been the largest solar and battery project in North America, located in the sunny Nevada desert north of Las Vegas. The massive solar project would have powered 2 million homes and provided thousands of jobs.
Okay, Nevada voters, when your electricity prices go up, now you know who to blame.
Finally, a new official report on Spain's massive blackout last spring during a major heat wave exonerates renewable energy as a cause. The new report confirms multiple other analyses showing that renewable energy was not one of the several triggers responsible for the blackout. However, misinformation immediately peddled by right-wing media and even U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright blaming renewable energy for the outage, that had a lasting impact. A recent survey found that 6 in 10 respondents in Spain believe that renewable energy was at fault. In reality, grid operators, particularly in Texas and California, say solar paired with battery storage has helped avoid power outages, and they perform extremely well in extreme heat, better than natural gas, according to the CEO of California's grid operator, Elliot Mainzer, in an interview with NPR.
During the kind of heat waves we've seen in recent years, that the natural gas plants can come under some significant strain, and we tend to see a higher outage rate amongst the gas fleet when the temperatures are really, really hot.
As usual, a lie makes its way around the world before the truth even gets its pants on.
Yep.
Especially when it comes to the lies put out by the fossil fuel industry about renewable energy. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Tell the truth.
So, Hutch over on Blue Sky writes about your Green News Report, Des, to ask, aren't these Alaskan cyclonicanes fairly typical this time of year? The storm that hit Alaska, he says, is this related to man-made climate change and the continued burning, use, and production of fossil fuels? And you have about 10 seconds to answer that
question.
Well,
I'll try to do it quickly. The North Pacific Ocean is record warm. And remember, this storm went all the way from Japan. It crossed the Pacific Ocean to Alaska because it had enough energy to do so. An Anchorage Daily News article quoted a meteorologist who said, quote, warm water along its virtually entire track gave it more energy than it otherwise would have had. There's certainly a climate change connection here. Would this have happened without an overheated North Pacific? Entirely possible, but it probably wouldn't have been as strong as it wound up being.
There you go. You ask, we answer. I am the Brad Blog over on Blue Sky. Desi is Green News Report. My thanks again to our guest today, Richard Von Glahn of People Not Politicians, and of course to our producer, Desi Doyen. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it for free at bradblog.com. You can also drop me an email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And hey, while you're there, please consider hitting a donate button or going to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Stop lying.